WNA Trailblazers is proudly brought to you by Davies Chocolates, makers of handcrafted Australian chocolates since 1932. Now gluten and palm oil free. Visit davieschocolates.com.au and order your selection online for speedy delivery to your door.
I suppose in the world of Walt Disney, is always looking forward, but there's always things that you can look at. And I like putting my entrepreneurial hat on. There's always a possibility, whether I act on it and go and follow that possibility, but I think it's exciting looking at what possibilities are. And so when you're sitting in that negative space, it doesn't feel good.
That's aviation training specialist Adrian Fleming, and this is WNA Trailblazers.
WNA.
Women's Network Australia.
Trailblazers.
Amplifying the stories of women in business. Hosted by Women's Network Australia CEO Cheryl Gray and Louise Poole, me, managing partner of podcast production company and official Women's Network Australia media partner, Welcome Change Media. Sometimes it feels like we're swimming against the tide when reaching for our goals, even when we've got cheerleaders to give us a boost. But imagine having the people in authority around you not even considering your dream as a remote possibility. Adrian Fleming beat those odds after being told in high school that she should aspire to be an air hostess because women don't become pilots. Today, she is living proof that as women, not only can we work towards any goal we choose, but accomplish much, much more along the way. I'm so excited to hear Adrian's story today because she has that persistence, that tenacity to keep the dream alive. And it is hard as a business owner, isn't it, sometimes when you haven't got a huge budget, a huge team behind you to keep going every day?
Absolutely. And look, we've had, as you know, Louise, some amazing guests on our podcast. But I think it's fair to say Adrian Fleming is a true trailblazer. Mm. You know, women pilots are still in these days pretty rare. But she's actually been in business for 30 years and is celebrating her 30th anniversary in business, in the aviation business, and achieved so much in that time. And she's just an inspiring woman.
Let's get into her story now.
Trailblazers.
Welcome to WNA Trailblazers. I'm delighted to have you as our podcast guest today because you really are a trailblazer and in a sector where women weren't necessarily welcomed, but we've certainly had some pioneers, and that's the aviation sector. What's your earliest memory of flying or wanting to fly?
So my earliest memory was back in primary school when I used to sit in the tree. It was a plum tree in my grandparents' backyard, and I used to climb that tree and then look up, and there was police aeroplanes flying over. So the police force in Victoria had a new air wing, and they were flying over, and I can assume that they were flying lower than normal aeroplanes. I don't really know this, but it did get my attention, and I could tell you that they were police aeroplanes, and so I wanted to be
low enough
there
to see what they were, huh?
Correct. I knew what they were. Not that I was doing anything wrong, I hope. And anyway, so I wanted to fly them. And so there was a little time in there where I thought that I had to be a policewoman to be able to do that, but that was sort of a means to an end.
So what happened when you finished school and you did want to pursue a career as a pilot?
When I finished school, there's a story that I've told many times where when I was in year 12, the year 12 coordinator, who was our vice principal at the time, you fill in a university preference card and it says, you know, what course you want to do at university. At the time, there wasn't any for aviation that I wanted to do. And so I didn't fill out the card because I thought it was a waste of time. And she called me up, sat me down and said, look, you haven't filled out your card other than your name. And I said, yes, that's right, because I don't want to go to university. And she said, well, what is it you want to do? And I said, well, I want to be a pilot. And she could have knocked her over with a feather. She rolled her eyes back, sat back in her chair and told me that, oh, I must mean an air hostess because women aren't pilots.
Did you feel when you heard that?
I actually thought, where had this woman been? I was in a school that I was one of four that did, they called themselves progressive at the time because they allowed, you know, women to do some of the sciences. So I did sort of straight sciences, maths, physics, chemistry. And I thought, well, this is meant to be a progressive school. And back when I was in primary primary school, Deborah Wardley became the first female to fly for one of the major airlines. And I watched that case, remembering saying to my mum, you know, what if I want to be a pilot, you know, and they don't let me in? You know, her response was, well, you know, we'll fight them, or the rules will have changed by then. So I guess for me, it was never really going to be an issue, because there was this woman who, she fought Reg Anson and she became a pilot, and I had the backing that I'd fight to be a pilot if I needed to. And where was this woman coming from that was my vice principal?
So did you feel that it actually maybe added to the fire that was in your belly?
It probably did in hindsight. I was probably more encouraged by being told I couldn't than I could, but I don't think that was why she did it.
You mean she honestly believed that women couldn't be pilots?
Correct.
So how did you go about braving that in potential discouragement and going on from there to actually getting in the sky?
Well, I knew you needed me to learn to fly, or you had to join the Air Force. I wasn't that keen on joining the Air Force at the time. And also, I didn't think my grades at school were high enough as well. I did see the recruiting person in the Air Force who sort of implied that maybe the effort or lack of effort that I put in at school probably wasn't enough. You know, I was one of those people who put in enough effort to pass. If I really liked something, I would put in a bit more effort. And I've changed a little bit since then, but that was the way I operated back then. And so the Air Force wasn't really going to be an option. And so I knew I had to pay for it. So I needed a job. So basically, I needed money to fly. And I was fortunate enough that I knew at the time my mother was the industrial officer for the Country Fire Authority. So I knew a little bit. I'd grown up sort of alongside the fire brigade, and they had an affirmative action program at the time where they were looking to have women because women weren't in the fire brigade. And so I then, that sort of sparked my interest, and I thought, oh, I could become a firefighter, because I know that obviously through my mother's connections that firefighters have 4 days on, 4 days off, and 10 weeks annual leave. And I thought, well, and they get paid reasonably well. So I thought, aha, this could be my ticket to my license. And that's what I could do. I actually then applied, funnily enough, for not wanting to go to university, but Swinburne had a course called fire technology. And so I applied for it. I'd started running it full time, and I never became a firefighter. I did graduate from the course, being the first female to get through the course. I was the only female on the course at the time. But in the process of that, there was a job that came up as was called a flight data officer, then later called an airways data systems officer. And what it was a dedicated flight data, which was the initial job that an air traffic controller used to do when they employed air traffic controllers. But because they hadn't employed any air traffic controllers for some time, they then said, well, we're short of air traffic controllers, so let's relieve them from doing that flight data job and put them into operational air traffic control. And then it's a lot quicker to train a flight data officer just to do the flight data part, not the air traffic control part. And so fortunately for me, it was a job in aviation, and I got that job as a flight data officer, and that then led to giving me enough money and obviously enough time to learn to fly.
So it was about edging closer to that dream.
I think it was always there. It was just a mechanism. You know, we talk about a means to an end, but I think it's a mechanism. It wouldn't have mattered what I did had I been scrubbing floors or whatever. The money I needed to learn to fly was the aim, because I had to fund it.
So from there, how many hours did you need to actually get your license? It's not like the car license, is it? It's a bit more complicated than that.
Well, funnily enough, I was at a school thing the other day where they talk about where they've done the driver education. And in Victoria, you need 120 hours, I think it is, to get your practice time, if you like, before you get a probationary license. And I asked the school children, I said, how many hours do you think you need for a pilot's license? Just a recreational one, not one to be a commercial pilot. And they're all judging it by the car amount of hours. And, you know, they're coming up with, oh, you must be maybe 50, flying's harder, so it must be 60. And in fact, the minimum global requirement for a private pilot's license is 40 hours of flying. However, most people take a bit longer than that. So it's quite interesting. So to get a commercial pilot's license, the minimum global hour standard is 150 hours. So when I was doing it, it was around 175 hours, which is probably the norm now, even with the minimums as well. So you go in stages. I got what we called a restricted license back then, where you're restricted to where you can carry passengers, but restricted where you can go. That then moved into a unrestricted license, which was the private pilot's license, where you can fly all around the country. Then you do some building your command time. So, you know, you're doing flights, taking your friends flying, going on trips, and then you book in for some consolidated, what we call commercial pilot license training. So you're in a higher performance aeroplane, and, you know, they put some, I guess, a little bit more pressure on you, if you like, you know, and the standards and tolerances of the flying is actually tighter than it is for the private license. So I went down that path. It didn't all happen at once. So I think I worked as a flight data officer for about almost 4 years. And throughout that time, I learned to fly over that period of time to get my commercial pilot's license.
And I think along the way, or at some point soon after, you met your husband, Jeff, ended up in what has been your business since then, and that's about training others to fly. Talk us through some of the challenges. You know, no doubt there were challenges being a woman in aviation in those early days, but going into business and raising a family at the same time, how was that?
Yeah, so it's interesting to think, because I heard someone say, you must be very brave. And I thought at the time, oh, I never thought of myself as brave. I took redundancy from Flight Data to continue on with my flying career because I didn't want to be, I could have been an air traffic controller or trained as an air traffic controller as well, but I opted not to do that. And yeah, so we set up a business. Now, the business probably wasn't my idea. It was my husband had it in his mind at the time. And the year we started, I talk about that being the year I completed my flight instructor rating. We started the business and I had my first son. And I also got my first gray hair. So I really don't know which combination, which one it was, or all three that actually created that. So the challenges of business, I think it was, for me, it was survival. I was fortunate enough, my husband actually had a full-time job working elsewhere. So I was always full-time in the business from its inception. And he worked sort of part-time on his days off in that space. So until he could then join it full-time a few years down the track. I guess there was no point that I ever thought that we would fail. I'm assuming it was survival instincts where you just have to keep going. And there's always been, we've had numerous challenges. You don't have a business for almost 30 years and not have challenges. But in those early days, I became a master of negotiating the contra. We didn't have a lot of money to start with, but I would convince a shopping center that they wanted to put my airplane in their center court for advertising, because often airplanes, we sort of adopt an approach of taking aviation out to the general public. So wherever people were, that's where we would try and present ourselves, because at an airport, I think when we started, there were 16 flying schools on the airport. And so when people come in and they knock on your door to learn to fly, of course, they're going to take your brochure and then they're going to knock on the next person's door or the next person's door. We had a bit of an advantage actually in our positioning at the time, because we were one of the first doors people potentially could knock on. But you always knew that they could go just next door. Whereas if you were out at a street festival or in a shopping centre, that audience, if you like, is sort of captive to you. And, you know, an aeroplane's a good draw card, particularly when nowadays, when you see them, they're either up in the sky where you can't touch them, or they're behind a fence where you can't touch them. So, you know, you put it in a shopping centre, people can touch and feel, and, you know, ignites all those people who come up to you and go, oh, I always wanted to fly, you know, something I always wanted to do. And that's probably one of the most common phrases that I hear. It's something that people have said, oh, I've always wanted to do that, rather than, oh, I saw an aeroplane and thought that would be good. Most of the time, it's that deep-seated thought that they've had for quite some time.
And I wonder how many young boys and girls you inspired by having that plane in the shopping centre, a bit like you in the plum tree at your grandma's house looking up at the police planes.
Yeah, I often wonder that too. I know that there's numerous people, obviously, we've given introductory flights to that have not necessarily flown with us but gone on to learn to fly. We're coming up to 30 years next year in business and we'll have a big celebration for that. But it's sort of meant that we've sort of gone back through some of the photo albums and had a look and, you know, you remember that person and remember what they did. And, you know, you look through these people and you see their airline captains or their check-in training captains in airlines. And some of them are flight instructors and they've been my sort of position as examiners and things. And you look and think, how many people have they then gone on to train as well? So there's lots of those points of contact. You're drawing out the tree, which I think is just fabulous because it's a marvelous industry to be a part of.
And 30 years is no mean feat in a business like yours, particularly through some pretty challenging times in terms of the whole aviation sector and the business sector and the GFC and all of those real challenges to business. I know that we have included you, and in fact, there's a picture of the Cessna 152 in the Southland Shopping Centre in 1994 in our Humble Leaders book. And as you say, some great shots to look back on for your 30th business anniversary. But you also were a pioneer out of the plane and on the ground. And speaking specifically of your role in some of the industry associations, the Australian Women Pilots Association, how you found that experience in terms of being a woman in other industry organisations too in your sector.
Yes, it's an interesting thing because I often don't see myself as a woman. And in this world where we talk genders and all sorts of types of genders, but, you know, when I'm in an aeroplane, I'm an instructor and I'm not a female instructor. I'm not a woman pilot. I'm a pilot. And I've always seen myself as that. The Australian Women Pilots Association that you mentioned has been instrumental to, I guess, opening doors for me and also strengthening how I feel about myself in this male-dominated world of aviation. Now, I'm not sure whether we'll ever get to a 50-50, as much as I'd love to have 50% women in the industry. And there has been huge progress, particularly in the last few years, and recognition being made. But it's one of those those things I often relate it to how many males are we going to have in childcare. It's not saying they can't do it, and there's plenty of good fathers and parents, male parents out there, but they just don't want to join the industry. So I think aviation is a little bit like that, but that doesn't mean you can't try. The Women Pilots Association, I guess, gave me the opportunity to be on a committee, which was probably one of the starting points of my, what I would call my, where I'm a volunteer-aholic.
Another one.
Yeah. Someone once told me, I was in India and met this fabulous woman who runs these tours, Mumbai Magic Tours, and she said, oh, when women get to middle age, you know, men buy a Ferrari and a fast car or a motorbike, and women join a not-for-profit. And I think I was there a little earlier than middle age. But the Women Pilots Association has been really good. I joined on a committee. I learned I had skills that I didn't know I had and developed skills in running a meeting. I remember chairing my first meeting, was petrified, to say the least. Couldn't think for about 2 hours before trying to rehearse and think, what on earth do I have to say? And there were some women in that association, got lifelong friends. There were some that in the early days I was totally intimidated by as well. And I would like to think that I'm not one of those now. I've reached, I look back and go, gee, I think I'm in that age group now. And I hope that I'm encouraging to young women. But it's been, as did I had, you know, Nancy Bird Walton, who was one of the founding members of the association. She was always an inspiration through my life. And I've been fortunate enough that I have met her on numerous occasions, as of many of the members who are of my vintage, if you like. But it has sort of led to other things. So me putting my hand up for other things. The Australian Air League, where I was the group executive commissioner, I sort of entered there through my business providing flights that were more affordable for young cadets. And we still do cadet flights these days as well. And just seeing the youth of Australia, it's really good when you get young kids who are interested in aviation. And even if they may not necessarily know they're interested in aviation, you get to mold and they get to see what aviation's about. And I think for me, that's really, really rewarding. Being the only female, not necessarily all the only, but often there is minimal women around the table. I was fortunate through the Women Pilots Association, there are all women around the table. However, in a lot of the other organisations and roles, so on the Regional Aviation Association of Australia's board, I'm one woman, one voice. However, I don't see myself as a token in that space. I think there's a lot less women probably at that level to choose from at the moment, but they are coming up. It's sort of, if there's less women who were there 30 years ago when I was, that means there's going to be less women where I'm at now. And so the idea is to try and fast track a few up to where we are now to get them in those places and make sure they've got the right experience and they're not just there because of their gender.
And of course, your contributions were recognised. You were awarded the Nancy Bird Walton Trophy in 2016 and then later recognised with an Order of Australia Medal. I'm sure you didn't do those things for that recognition, but what meaning did that have for you to receive some of those accolades?
The Nancy Bird Walton Award was super special. I think it's because it's probably being recognised by people you've, I guess, respected and looked up to in the time. And a story about the Nancy Bird Walton Award, many years ago when I joined the association, I went to, they have an annual conference, and one of the women who I knew quite well, she received the Nancy Bird Walton Trophy. And I was so excited for her. And, you know, we had a little bit of an after party and, you know, that was pretty exciting in those days. And I remember saying to her, you know, that's really amazing. I don't think I'd ever be able to do anything that would deserve such an award. And, you know, it took 20 odd years later and I received the award, but I didn't go out there doing everything. I was just doing what I do. And you're quite right. You don't go out there for recognition, but that was quite meaningful. The only thing I have that's sad about that award is I wish I'd, in some respects, Nancy had been still around to present it, but, you know, that's life. And then the Order of Australia Medal, I was fortunate to have received a copy of the application. And boy, people put in a lot of work for these things, and very humbled that someone could actually even go to the trouble of putting in the amount of work they did for such an application. And part of it actually had worked out that through their means of sneakiness and asking all people around me and not telling me, was that I'd, over a period of 20 years, I had equated to 3 entire years of volunteering.
Wow.
And that was a bit of an eye-opener for me. I did have a touch of sense of guilt that maybe I could have been using that for other things. There was an inkling of that, of how much effort and work you do. You do put in and you do volunteer, but you don't do it the accolades at all. You do it because that's what you enjoy doing, and particularly in an industry that I really like, and it's given me so much. So it's important, I think, to give back.
There's 5 tips that you give in your chapter in the book, and I just wanted to explore a couple of those today. And the first one is, don't be afraid to ask. The worst response is no. You'll be more often than not surprised with a yes. Is that something that that you had to do or felt comfortable doing in both in the business and throughout your professional career?
I've learned that tip, and it took me quite a long time to learn that tip. I like to sit back and just watch, and I enjoy watching people, and that's one of my pleasures in life. And quite often I wouldn't put my hand up and I wouldn't ask because I would already have worked out what the answer could be. And on a couple of occasions where I did ask, where I was expecting a no, I received a yes. And I went, oh, okay. Now, funnily enough, I'd had some male role models, I guess, who would actually ask it anything, you know, and almost to the point where I would roll my eyes and think, oh, here we go again. And as of watching them, I started to see that most of the time actually seemed to get a yes. So what the heck? And so it was put a little bit of an act on. And Nancy Bird, who we mentioned earlier, I've got a photo of her and my daughter on my desk. And quite often I look at her when somebody asks me to do something, I look at it and I would normally have defaulted to a no. And in my mind, I go, what would Nancy say? And Nancy would go, you know, she would definitely say, you know, go out there and do it, dear. So it's part of that sort of philosophy that it's okay to say yes. And then when you do ask, you know, guess what? People will say yes. There's more people out there that are likely to say yes, and you've lost nothing if they say no.
Yeah, it's a really good lesson. Your other tip was never dwell on the negative. It only expands. And I think a lot of us, certainly through the COVID period and even in the past 12 months, have had plenty of negative experiences. How do you maintain that positivity?
I suppose in the words of Walt Disney, is always looking forward, but there's always things you can look at. And I like, I guess, putting my entrepreneurial hat on. You know, there's always a possibility, whether I act on it and go and follow that possibility. But I think it's exciting looking at what possibilities are. And so when you're sitting in that negative space, it doesn't feel good and there's no point sitting in it. And so, you know, you always, you know, I've mentioned about flipping a coin. You know, there's always just flip the coin to the other side. If you don't like it, turn it over. For me, I've found, interestingly enough, as we're going into COVID, I did my first ever podcast. And that was one of those ones where I was going to go, no, I don't want to do that. I'm too scared. And Nancy Bird convinced me that it was a good idea to say yes. So now I don't hesitate. I'll just say yes. But going into COVID, there was lots of uncertainty. And I made comment to my husband saying, we've had uncertainty before. I won't say we thrive on uncertainty, but there's always something. And I'm sure it's in any business, not just an aviation business, but there's always something. And COVID was just another something. We've been preparing for this for the last 20 odd years for another something. It was a different something, but you know, you just have to look at what other things are about and what you can do. And I said, I've got a supportive husband that we can bounce things off all the time, and that helps. And so staying in that positive space just makes life so much more bearable.
Your other tip is about the importance of a good and supportive network. And I know that you value your membership of Women's Network Australia, and we certainly value yours. How does that supportive network link back to that don't be afraid to ask question?
Well, Women's Network has been, I guess, instrumental in lots of areas of things that I've wanted to do. And, you know, being able to contact a point of contact and say, hey, do you know anybody? I guess that has eliminated some of that fear to ask, because it's a connection I already have. So it's not a cold call in that instance. And that's what I find really good about networks. So just as, say, Nancy Bird would sort of say, you know, who do I call when there's a problem? I'm sure her black book was huge. I think Women's Network is a bit like that in that instance. If you don't know somebody, the next person along will know somebody. And I think that's true with any network. And if you've got supportive people around you, you can lean on them. And most people are willing to share. You might get someone who's not, but I think there's a lot of value to be had when you're actually in that giving mode. And so when you ask, you're actually giving someone the other opportunity to give. So you're making their day as well.
Can I ask you, if you were back with that deputy principal and you were listening into that conversation, what would you say now?
Yeah, I've often thought about that. I'd probably be, if it was me personally sitting in the chair, I think I'd be more cheeky and I'd actually say what I was thinking and say that I thought that she was incorrect and stand up for myself. But if I was listening to the conversation as a third party, when the person got up, I would go and encourage the actual individual. I don't think it's for somebody else to squash someone else's dreams. And I often think this in the primary school phase, in that grade 4, grade 5, I did a thing with some, I had to test a logo out for something and we were doing it with grade 4s and grade 5s and grade 6s, which were the target market. And if you ask a question to a grade 6, you know, who wants to be a pilot? All the boys and girls are putting their hands up in the early years. And then as you get to about that grade 4, grade 5, it starts to go down. And it's that area where somebody has sort of told them, you know, no, or they can't do it. Or there's a belief somewhere that they can't do it. And I think that's where an area where we need to work on. So similarly, in that year 12 scenario, I would take the person aside and give them a pep talk and tell them if that's what they wanted to do, that's where they should be heading.
Well, we're extremely lucky, and no doubt the hundreds, if not thousands, of people who've who've gone through TriStar Aviation and learned to fly with you and your team are incredibly grateful that you stuck to that dream that you had and you did not get discouraged at that point, but in fact, it drove you on. So thanks so much for your time today and thank you for being a WNA trailblazer.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I hope that when Adrian got her pilot's license, she sent a copy of that maybe in a photo to her old deputy principal. I really do.
Yeah, look, you know, if only we could sort of go back in time and be that fly on the wall at those moments. But in some ways, you know, maybe that contributed to the drive that she's actually had throughout her professional and life journey.
Mm.
You know, when someone tells you no, sometimes it lights that fire to say, well, I'm going to prove you wrong. And certainly she has, in this case, an incredibly inspiring story from being up that tree in her grandma's backyard looking up at the police planes flying overhead to deciding I'm going to be that person who flies those planes and to be doing it and now spending her time helping other people, young people, learn to have that same dream and put it into reality. How good's that?
That's amazing, yeah, to actually be able to be living your dream and helping other people live theirs. I think, yeah, she's got the blessed life that she deserves. Wonderful. How can we connect with Adrian?
Well, look, you can connect to Adrian through TriStar Aviation, but you know what? The best way to find out more about Adrian is in the WNA book called Humble Leaders, and that's available for sale through our website, womensnetworkaustralia.com. There's an amazing chapter from Adrian in that book. There's also some really cute photographs, including that one I mentioned, the Cessna 152 in the Southland Shopping Centre in 1994. What a buzz that would have been for people at the shopping centre at that time. And, you know, who knows? Perhaps it was that someone who was there that day in that shopping centre was inspired by that moment to take to the air. So you just never know where those points of contact come into being. You can have a look at that book, Humble Leaders, available through the Women's Network website, womensnetwork.com.au.
Also a great place to connect with us and share with us thoughts on who else you'd like to hear on the WNA Trailblazers podcast. And, you know, while you're there, give us some 5-star reviews for the podcast too. So more people can discover it. Women's Network Australia is a business network for women that's been around for over 30 years. And like Women's Network Australia, Davies Chocolates has a proud history and a love of innovation. Davies Chocolates has been making handcrafted chocolates since 1932. And the chocolate making traditions of the past have been mixed with the needs of today, with all your favourites now made with delicious gluten-free and palm oil-free gourmet chocolate. Visit davieschocolates.com.au and order your selection online for speedy delivery to your door. Davies Chocolates are a proud sponsor of WNA Trailblazers. Do you know a trailblazing woman in business whose story needs to be amplified? Let us know. Drop us a line on the Contact Us page at womensnetwork.com.au. Thinking about making your own podcast? Welcome Change Media would love to help. Visit welcomechangemedia.com.au. WNA Trailblazers is a Welcome Change Media production.